Last Sabbath, there was an article in the Telegraph supplement over here, and the article was on Azerbaijan. Now, how many of you would know where Azerbaijan is? Because I must admit, I wasn't absolutely certain. I knew roughly, but you know, if you're actually finding a place, you need to know a bit more than roughly. And it is actually on the shores of the Caspian Sea. You go from the Caspian Sea, you come to Azerbaijan, which is right on the shores. You then come to Armenia, and then you come to Turkey. And today, actually, in the same Telegraph magazine, it must be that they're running some kind of a series on this area, because there's an analysis of the Beslan politics in that area. Now, Beslan is a bit north in Russia itself, because you've got Georgia, which is just north of Azerbaijan, and in Russia itself, and Chechnya, which is also in that area within Russia, or within the Russian-controlled area. And of course, Beslan was the school where this atrocity occurred. Now, if I can just read you what it actually says today within the supplement, because I thought it was quite interesting. I'll just read one paragraph, or maybe a couple of paragraphs from here. It says, "Talk of vengeance is rife in Beslan. Many of those I spoke to feared, like Irina," this is the person who was talking to, "once the mourning period was up, the bloodshed would begin. An Ossetian who lives in Kurtat and who lost a niece in the school had been visiting other Ossetian homes." Now, these are different areas. Ossetia is also within there. "Ossetian homes to try and talk them out of revenge. Hardly any Ossetians in Kurtat lost relatives in the school because it's outside the catchment area," she said. "My neighbors are all Ingush, I-N-G-U-S-H. But they're not guilty just because of that. It's the people who did this terrible thing who are the guilty ones. I keep begging the Ossetians not to think of revenge, but they won't listen. They don't seem to understand that if there is another war, we will lose more of our children. Slaviv Gozov, a farm laborer in his 30s, told me, the Ingush must be exterminated. If we don't launch a war against them, they will never stop killing us. We must murder every last one of them, and only then will we be safe." Now, I think it doesn't take a genius to see what will happen. They're waiting, actually. The 40 days of mourning is just drawing to a close. And there is a tradition within the area that they wait 40 days of mourning, mourning for lost loved ones. And then the revenge starts. And this is what everybody is fearing. Now, just below this area, Chechnya, just below these areas, this area of Beslan, is this area of Azerbaijan. And in this article that was the week before, it mentions here, it says, "With pools of oil oozing to the surface and catching fire spontaneously, it was the birthplace of Zoroastrianism, the religion of the fire worshippers. The world's first oil well was drilled here in 1849. By the early years of the 20th century, that's 1900s, just the very early years there, Azerbaijan was supplying almost half the world's oil. Half the world's oil came out of this area back at the beginning of this century. It goes on, I'm skipping across the article. It says, "BP leads a consortium which 10 years ago signed the contract of the century to bring Western finance and technology to the exhausted Baku oil industry. Next year, a pipeline will open from Baku to the Turkish coast, allowing Caspian oil to be exported without the envious Russian bear getting its paws on it. Then Azerbaijanis will be able to sit back and let the dollars flow in." So you can imagine the amount of oil that's going to go ahead and flow to the west, and how strategically important this area is. And it's going through Turkey. The oil pipeline goes right through Turkey to the coast. And Turkey controls the Bosphorus as well. And remember, there's also Armenia. And Armenia has had a war with Azerbaijan in the past. And it says here, it says, "New conflict with Armenia could be one spark for global conflagration. Another is the dispute over sharing of Caspian oil with Iran and Azerbaijan already sparring." So there's difference of opinion as to who owns this oil between Azerbaijan and Iran, because Iran is just south of Azerbaijan. It comes up to the south. So all these nations are all coming up this area of the Caspian Sea. If these two countries come to war, it's not hard to see America siding with Azerbaijan and seizing the opportunity to have a bash at Tehran under the pretext of protecting billions of oil investments. The loudest rhetoric in Washington now is of the need for a preemptive strike to stop Iran going nuclear. With intelligence now discredited as a reason for going to war, a skirmish among the oil rigs of the Caspian Sea would be a perfect justification for attacking Iran, with the Israeli Air Force joining in to demolish the mullah's nuclear bunkers. The Caspian Sea is the source of the world's oil outside OPEC for years to come. It's the greatest non-OPEC exporting area, is this area on the Caspian Sea around Azerbaijan. The strategic stakes cannot be exaggerated. It may be that these black and neglected landscapes will become as familiar on our television screens as the paddy fields of Vietnam or the deserts of Iraq. As I say, it's a very, very important area, and I thought, having read that article, and also the way in which oil, the article is about the way in which oil actually defeats democracy. And the reason is, if you look where oil has been used, Nigeria is one. Saddam Hussein in Iraq is another. Saudi Arabia is another, where you've got despots, where you've got people who have absolute control. They've got no need to go to the populace whatsoever, because they become the benefactors giving to the populace. And this is the Gentile mindset. And you now have Azerbaijan, who is also, the oil wealth is within the hands of a one ruling family. And so you've got a classic Gentile mindset within that area. And an enormous amount of conflict and tensions. Islam is in there, and you've got, again, Turkey, which is the almost like a bridge into Europe, and you've got a real potential problem. So what I want to do today is to talk about a key prophetic player in this area. There is one key prophetic player for this area that we shouldn't be ignorant about. And that key prophetic player is Edom. It's Esau. Now, we need to remain alert. We need to remain alert to what God has said about this area, about Turkey particularly, and about what God has said is going to happen. And also a little bit about the history as well. Because this area and this oil pipeline that's coming from Azerbaijan, that's going in through Turkey, going to the west, and it's about to start pumping oil. It's about, literally about to start, beginning, I think it is, of next year. It is going to become quite crucial. So what I thought I'd do is, I'd go into the history, a little bit of the history, go back into scripture and look at some of the history of Edom. Secondly, I want to talk about the Old Testament fulfillment of prophecies, because it did actually occur. There are prophecies that you'll see, and they were fulfilled in type already, but they're going to be fulfilled again in actuality, as we'll see. So I want to go into the Old Testament fulfillment a little. Thirdly, I want to talk about where is Edom today, because it's a little bit more than just Turkey. Turkey is certainly one of the grandsons of Edom. But where are the others? And this is a little bit of what I'd like to talk about. Fourthly, the end time prophecies about Edom, because Edom is going to figure very prominently at the end time. It's going to have an enormous impact, from what we can gather, on Britain, America, Israel, and so on, and Europe, and the Far East as it comes down, and so on. It's very important. So those are the areas I want to cover. And if we just have a look, therefore, let's have a look at the very early history. Turn over to Genesis 25. Genesis chapter 25, and let's just have a look at in verse 19. Now, in Genesis 25, if you notice, here was what Rebekah was told. In verse 19 it says, "And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife, because she was barren, and the Eternal was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, 'If it's so, why am I thus?' And she went to inquire of the Eternal." Now, exactly how she inquired of the Eternal, it's not explained, but she went to inquire of the Eternal. And the Eternal said to her, two nations are in your womb. Now here the Eternal is actually speaking, Jesus Christ is speaking to Rebecca and telling her what in fact she's experiencing. And two types of people shall be separated from your bowels, and the one people will be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. There's something he could see even within the character of the boys within the womb at that time. He could, God or Christ could actually see down through the ages to come. In verse 24 it says, and when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob, and Jacob, which means supplanter, and Jacob was and Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter and a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And Jacob boiled pottage, or you know, soup, and Esau came in from the field and was faint. He'd obviously been out hunting for some hours and perhaps even days, who knows. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray, with that same red, that red pottage, that red soup, for I'm faint, and therefore his name was called Edom, which means red. It's the same base root that we get the word Adam, which is the red clay, and Adama, which means earth or ground from which Adam was taken. And Edom is the same red. And Jacob said, sell me this day your birthright. And Esau said, behold, I'm at the point to die. What profit does this birthright do to me? And Jacob said, swear to me this day. And he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils. And he ate and he drank and rose up, went his way. And Esau therefore despised his birthright. So this is what Rebekah had been told. And here is how Jacob went and supplanted Esau and actually took the birthright from him. And if we notice over in chapter 27, in verse 6, it says, Rebekah spoke to Jacob her son, verse 6, Genesis 27, saying, behold, I heard your father speak to Esau your brother, saying, bring me venison, make me savory food, that I may eat and bless you before the Eternal, before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to that which I am commanding you. So Rebekah, remember, knew what the promises were. She remembers what would have been said when she went to inquire of the Eternal, and she knew that this younger, the older, is going to serve the younger. Now if we notice down in verse 26, we find his father Isaac said to him, come near now, mine, kiss me, my son. And he came near and kissed him, and he smelt the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, see, the smell of my son is the smell of the field which the Eternal has blessed. Therefore God give you the dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth. Well, we've got plenty of dew of the heaven over here in Wales this time. And the fatness of the earth, and it does, it makes the grass grow. And plenty of corn and wine, and let people serve you, and nations bow down to you, and be Lord over your brothers, and let your mother's sons bow down to you, and cursed is everyone that curses you, and blessed is everyone that blesses you. And it came to pass, as soon as Isaac has made the end, then Esau came in, and he said, well, who is he? He asked who he was. It goes down, then the deception is then shown as to what, as he says, verse 35, he says, your brother came with subtlety and have taken away your blessing. And he said, isn't it rightly named Jacob, or supplanter? For he supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now he's taken away my blessing. And haven't you reserved a blessing for me? And Isaac answered and said, I've made him Lord, your Lord, and all his brethren have I given to him for servants. And with corn and wine I've sustained him, and what shall I do now to you, my son? And Esau said to his father, have you not but one blessing? And Esau lifted his voice and wept. And Isaac his father answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling shall be thee, or away from thee, is a better, Moffat says, shall be away from the fatness of the earth, and away from the dew of heaven from above. And by your sword shall you live, and shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass that when you have the dominion, that you'll break his yoke from off your neck. So even there's a prophecy going down into the future about how it was by the sword that Edom would go ahead and rule. And how in fact at the end, well, basically at the end time, it certainly be the case that he breaks the yoke off the neck. Now, if you look in various commentaries and so on as to what this, how this was fulfilled, you'll find a fulfilment of a type that has already happened. However, there's a great deal more to it than just this type. We turn over to 2 Samuel chapter 8. 2 Samuel chapter 8. So we see how Edom, and it's interesting, in Genesis 25 it shows very clearly that he's called Edom because he was red, and he was called Edom particularly because of the red soup that he sold his birthright for. But in 2 Samuel chapter 8, we find here over in verse 13, it says, "And David got him a name when he returned from smiting the Syrians in the Valley of Salt, 18,000. And he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all of Edom put he garrisons, and all of they of Edom became David's servants," became the slaves, became the servants of David. "And the Eternal preserved David wherever he went." So here we see how David, when he first started the kingship, he put Edom in subjection, and Edom became under subjection. If you want to put in your notes 1 Kings 22, verse 47, it talks there about there wasn't a king in Edom, it was a deputy that David had actually put into place, and subsequent kings had put in place, and they actually ruled Edom on behalf of Israel and Judah. In 2 Kings chapter 8, if you notice, let's go to 2 Kings chapter 8, and verse 16, we see the time when, in fact, Edom puts the yoke off his neck. Now, this is what they see as the fulfillment of the prophecy. But as I said, there's more to it than this. But it says in verse 16 of 2 Kings chapter 8, it says, "In the fifth year of Joram, the sixth son of Ahab, king of Israel, Jehoshaphat being then king of Judah, Joram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, began to reign." So there's Joram, son of Ahab, in the north, and there's Joram, the son of Jehoshaphat, in the south. 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. And he walked in the ways of the king of Israel, as did the house of Ahab, for the daughter of Ahab was his wife. And this is Athaliah, as far as I remember. "And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal. And yet the Eternal would not destroy Judah for David his servant's sake, as he promised to give him always a light to his children. And in his days, Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah, and made a king over themselves." So here we find there was a king that they appointed to themselves. "And so Joram went over to Zair, and all the chariots with him, and rose by night, smote the Edomites which compassed him about. Yet Edom," verse 22, "revolted under the hands of Judah to this day." Now, presumably this, exactly which canonization period this refers to, I'm not sure. I would have had to actually check. But I would imagine it would be Ezra and Nehemiah. That even to this day, in Ezra and Nehemiah's time, you're looking at Edom having revolted under the hand of Judah, and in fact the Maccabees then put them under subjection again, as we'll go on and talk about, and Libna revolted at the same time. Now, the racial strain, if you start to look at the racial strain, because there are certain scriptures, Deuteronomy 20, put in your notes again, Deuteronomy 23 verse about 3 to 8, it talks about Moab and Ammon, and how they, the sons of Lot, were against Israel, and how Edom were to be respected, and how within Moab and Ammon were not allowed into the congregation for 10 generations, but an Edomite was allowed in within 3 generations. So they were looked upon as almost like brethren in some ways. But you look at the Turks, do they look like us? And the answer is, well, they don't really, do they? Well, let's have a look at the racial strain involved. Turn over to Genesis 25. Genesis 25. And we start to see probably some of the reasons, why this is the case. In Genesis 25, in verse 12, it says, "Now these are the generations of Ishmael." Now, let's first of all, we'll look at Ishmael, because Edom married into Ishmael. This is one of the wives of Edom, of Esau, was in fact a descendant of Ishmael. Now these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, who Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bare unto Abraham. So immediately, when you're looking at Ishmael, you're looking at he is half Egyptian. He's not just the kind of the line that came from Abraham. He's also half Egyptian as well. So you immediately have half Egyptian there. Now, if we notice, if you go back, let's see, let's have a look over in chapter 21. Well, keep your hand in chapter 25. Just turn back to chapter 21 and notice in verse 21, talking about Ishmael, it says, "And he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother," that's Hagar, "took him a wife out of the land of Egypt." So anything, any progeny that came from Ishmael married an Egyptian. So again, you're looking at the progeny. Now if you notice in verse chapter 25, go back to 25 again, and in verse 13 it says, "And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names according to the generations. The firstborn of Ishmael is Nebajoth, and Kedar, and Abdeel, and Mizbam." And if you know, if you, this particular one, Nebajoth, is the firstborn. And if we go now over a couple of pages to Genesis 27, Genesis 27, it is a Bible study after all. In Genesis 27, first of all, let's have a look at, well, first of all, let's just see who in fact Esau married, first of all, in verse 46 of 27. In verse 46, "And Rebekah said to Isaac, I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife of the daughters of Heth, such as these, which are the daughters of the land, what good shall my life do to me?" And we notice what these particular daughters were. In verse chapter 28 now, in verse 8, it says, "And Esau, seeing that the daughters of Canaan did not please Isaac his father." So the daughters of Heth, the daughters of Canaan, these are black. So two of his wives were actually black. But he then went ahead, he said, "Then went Esau to Ishmael and took the wives which he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife." So here he now took this sister of Nebajoth, and remember, she would be three quarters Egyptian. So she was only a quarter white, Esau was. So they actually, if you like, diluted the line. You're looking at a very different ethnic grouping from Israel. You're looking at something which is heavily Egyptian. That is, one of the wives produced children that were coming from the Egyptian side, three quarters of which were Egyptian. And two of the wives were Canaanite, so half Canaanite. So it was quite a different, it wasn't like Jacob. Very different line from Jacob. And again, it's quite revealing as far as what his attitude to his birthright was. His attitude to his birthright was to despise it. And he went out and married whoever he wanted to. He didn't go ahead and marry true to his kind, which Jacob did. Jacob was sent out by his parents, and he went and okay, he married two, but he still married true to his kind. Now, the area that the Edomites lived, and if we turn over to Genesis 36, Genesis 36, they were living, they actually lived primarily in the Rift Valley. Now there's a Rift Valley that stretches from Turkey all the way down the Sea of Galilee, right down the Jordan, into the Dead Sea, which is the deepest point. And it carries on there right the way through to the Gulf of Aqaba, isn't it, where the Eilat is. And it terminates at Eilat and goes into the sea there. Now Eilat is this, remember we just had the bombing over right next to Eilat. This valley from the Dead Sea going south to the area of Eilat, in that valley, about 20 miles wide by about 100 miles long, is the area that was known as Edom. And it had very steep cliffs on either side. And they lived in the bottom of the valley, and also they lived in the actual caves within the cliffs. On the east side, about in the middle, as you go down that valley, is Petra, or Selah, and Mount Seir. And this, they were the people who actually inhabited that area of Mount Seir, that area of Petra, at that time. You can find in Genesis 32, verse 3, where it talks about Mount Seir. You can also find it in here in Genesis 36. Notice it's talking here about verse 1. Now, these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. So Esau and Edom are one and the same. Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan, Adar, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zebon the Hivite. In fact, and did I say two? You've got three, and also this other one as well. Oh no, that's right. This other one, this third one. Two of them were Canaanites, but the other one was the daughter, or the granddaughter, of Ishmael. And if you notice down in verse 8, it says, "Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir." So this is Mount Seir. So where you see Mount Seir being mentioned, at this early time, you find Edom being the nation that's actually dwelling there. It says, "Esau is Edom." And these are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in Mount Seir. So here we see the Edomites, notice, in Mount Seir. Because there's evidence that Edomites also were pushed across over towards what became Persia. But the Edomites in Mount Seir had an influence on Judah and Jerusalem and Israel as well, and these were the ones who were known as Edomites. It's interesting that when you look at Israel, God does clearly say that He won't let a grain fall to the ground. But you don't find that amongst the Gentile nations in the same degree. You'll find that they'll mix themselves among the nations much more, and certainly the attitude of Edom, as you will go on and we'll see and mentioned over in Hebrews, is to despise his birthright, and it's actually linked with fornication. It's linked with a fornicating attitude of mind where you simply want the pleasure for the moment and then blow the consequences. There's no generation that will then come from the union. And this attitude of mind is a dismissive attitude of mind that also undoubtedly went into the progeny as well that were produced. But here, as we say, it says in verse 8 of chapter 36, Esau dwelt in Mount Seir, Esau is Edom, and these are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in Mount Seir. Now in verse 10 it says, "These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Adar, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Bashemath, the wife of Esau." And the sons of Eliphaz were Teman. So where you find the city of, or the town of Teman mentioned, and if you notice in places like Habakkuk, you find that God comes back to Teman, Paran, and these areas are Edom. And it talks about well, we'll read a little bit later about about Teman, about Christ in dyed garments from Bozrah. And these areas, and Teman was one of the sons, he was the grandson of Edom. And we see he's the firstborn, he's the son of the firstborn, which was Eliphaz. So here is the dominant tribe. And where do we see that name today? We see it in Ottoman, Ottoman. And the Ottoman Turks were coming from this, presumably, this Teman, the Ottoman Turks. And it goes down in verse 15, it says, "And these were the dukes of the sons of Esau, the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, Duke Teman, Duke Omar, Duke Zepho, Duke Kenaz," and so on. But Teman was, they were, they had a dukedom. And in verse 31, it says, and these are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. So the kings that we just read about them revolting in the time of Jehoshaphat, that was a new kingdom. But before there was any kings, they did have kings within Edom. And it says, and Bela the son of Beor reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dinhabba. And Bela died, and Jodab the son of Zerah of Bozrah reigned in his stead. And if you go through these, you'll find that they're all coming from different areas, and they're coming from, if you like, different sides. It's almost as if the dukes were in control within Edom, and they then appointed a king. The dukes would appoint a king to rule over them for the length of his life, and then they would get, he would die, and then come together, and another one would then be appointed. So it wasn't just a straightforward. And within here, you see, notice in verse 33, Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his stead. So here again, we have Bozrah in the land of Edom, and it talks about his clothes dyed red. Notice Edom again. He's talking coming from Bozrah, and you're looking again at the various names that you will find through Scripture. It's not just Edom you being used. It's not just Bozrah. It's not just Teman. It's all of them. You can see them all being used. Another one that you'll find being used occasionally is Idumea. Now Idumea is Greek and it means pertaining to Edom. This is coming from New Unger's Bible Dictionary. It says, Idumea, pertaining to Edom in Greek, this is a term employed by Greeks and Romans for the country of Edom. And it gives certain references there. So again, there's another area that if you're doing any Bible study on this, you need to be aware that if you come across Idumea or Idumean, then you'll find that that also is talking about Edom and Edomites. Now when we look at the Old Testament fulfillment, if you notice over in Jeremiah, so that's a bit of background, historical background, but if we go to Jeremiah 25 and we see some of the prophecies that are being mentioned here in Jeremiah 25, we can see an axial period that occurred around the time of Jeremiah. Now this is a crucial axial period because this axial period began the rise of Babylon as we know it. The Babylon, but not as we know it. It's Babylon as we know it. It's the Babylon that we have today. It caused Assyria to go down, and all the previous kingdoms went down. And from that time of Jeremiah and the rise of Babylon, that really began our present era. This is the present era that we're in today. In Jeremiah 25, over in verse 15, it says, for thus says the eternal God of Israel to me. Notice who he's saying to. He's saying to him, to me, Jeremiah now. Take the wine cup of this fury at my hand and cause all nations to drink to whom I send you. Notice you, thee. That's singular. To drink it. He's talking specifically to Jeremiah. And they shall drink and be moved and be mad because of the sword that I will send among them. And I took, and notice, Jeremiah took the cup of the Eternal's hand, and he made, that's Jeremiah, made all the nations to drink unto whom the Eternal had sent me. So these are the nations that were about to be overthrown and be leveled out, so that this Babylonian system could then rise within the world. And he says, to wit, Jerusalem, the cities of Judah, the kings thereof and the princes thereof, to make them a desolation, an astonishment, a hissing, and a curse, as it is this day. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he says, as it is this day. Now, presumably that's been added by Ezra in the canonization of Ezra. And Ezra went back to put that right. But as when he was writing it, it was as it was. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his servants, and his princes, and all his people. So Egypt went down. It was, you know, just disappeared to a large degree as a major power. All the mingled people, all the kings of the land of Uz, some of these we've never even heard of, and all the kings of the lands of the Philistines, and Ashkelon, and Azar, and Ekron, and the remnant of Ashdod, Edom, and Moab, and the children of Ammon. So Edom actually went down at that time as well. So Edom went down and was changed at that time. And all the kings of Tyre, all the kings of Sidon, the kings of the isles beyond the sea, Dedan, Tamar, Buz, all the uttermost corners, all the kings of Arabia, all the kings of the mingled people that dwell in the desert, and the kings of Zimri and Elam and the kings of the Medes, and all the kings of the north, far, near, one with another, and all the kingdoms of the world which are upon the face of the earth, and the king of Shishak shall drink after them. Shishak was Babylon. You can look that up in Jeremiah 51, verse 41, if you want to put it in your notes. Jeremiah 51, 41, Shishak is identified as Babylon. And Babylon drank after them. This is the rise of the Babylonian system that Daniel and the beasts of Daniel. So our modern system, what we see today, this was the axial period. And during this axial period, we're looking at the destruction, very much, of Edom. Edom is mentioned in verse 21. Now in Jeremiah 49, if you turn over to Jeremiah 49, you see a prophecy here that is dual, that is concerning this axial period of Jeremiah, that causes, after the way in which they treated Jerusalem, that the Eternal in fact wiped them out. But it says in verse 7 of Jeremiah 49, it says, concerning Edom, thus says the Eternal of hosts, is wisdom no more in Teman? And again, remember, he was the grandson of Edom, and so there is the principal, it was the major, the capital, I suppose, of Edom. Is counsel perished from the prudent? Is their wisdom vanished? Flee, turn back, dwell deep, O inhabitants of Dedan. And I think you'll find that that's also one of the grandsons. For I'll bring the calamity of Esau upon him, the time that I will visit him. If grape gatherers come to you, would they not leave some gleaning grapes? If thieves by night, they will destroy until they've had enough. But I have made Esau bare. I've uncovered his secret places, and he shall not be able to hide himself. His seed is spoiled, his brethren and his neighbors, and he is not. Now this is the Edom that was to the south of Jerusalem. This is this rift valley from the area of the Dead Sea all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, to Eilat. It says, leave your fatherless children, I will preserve them alive, and let your widows trust in me. In fact, the men were massacred later on. It says, for thus says the Eternal, behold, they whose judgment was not to drink of the cup have assuredly drunken. And are you he that altogether go unpunished? You shall not go unpunished, but you will surely drink of it. For I have sworn in myself, says the Eternal, that Bozrah shall become a desolation, a reproach, a waste, and a curse, and all the cities thereof shall be perpetual wastes. And if you go into the area today, you'll find it is the Vale of Salt. I have heard a rumor from the Eternal, and an ambassador is sent to the heathen, saying, gather together and come against her and rise up to the battle. For lo, I'll make you small among the nations and despised among men. Your terribleness has deceived you, and the pride of your heart. O you that dwell in the clefts of the rock, that hold the height of the hill, though you should make your nest as high as an eagle, I'll bring you down from there, says the Eternal. And Edom shall be a desolation. Every one that goes by it shall be astonished, and shall hiss at the very plagues thereof. And as the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the neighboring cities thereof, says the Eternal, no man shall abide there, neither shall the son of man dwell there. Behold, he shall come like a lion from the swelling of the Jordan against the inhabitation of the strong, but I will suddenly make him run away from her, and so on. But the interesting thing here is that it flows from this axial period of Jeremiah into the end time. And Edom at the end time is going to be wiped out, largely wiped out. Now there is indications that there will be some again, we will go and have a look at this in a little while, but there will be some that probably will survive, probably from the children and from the women that are there, but the men apparently seem to have been wiped out. He says, therefore, hear verse 20, the counsel of the Eternal that has taken against Edom, and the purposes he's purposed against the inhabitants of Teman. Surely the least of the flock shall draw them out, surely and make them habitations desolate with them. The earth is moved at the noise of their fall, at the cry of the noise was heard in the Red Sea. Behold, he'll come up and fly as an eagle, and spread his wing over Bozrah, and all that day shall the heart of the mighty men of Edom be as the heart of women in her pangs. They say, there's a duality there. If you want to put in your notes, Psalm 137, and now that is, we sing that by the waters of Babylon. It's about the Bible, the waters of Babylon, where he sat down and sang, but he talks about Edom there and how the Edomites actually said, down with Jerusalem and down to the dust, to the ground, to the foundation. And he was against Jerusalem, and that for that reason, God therefore put vengeance on Edom. Now, what then happened was that Nebuchadnezzar actually worked, if you like, with they encouraged Nebuchadnezzar to go ahead and take Jerusalem, but the Nabateans then pushed them northward, and they took over all their area. The Nabateans massacred a large number of them. Then, when the Maccabees finally came in, they imposed circumcision on what was left, whatever had been regenerated, and they then sided themselves. And if you again put in your notes, Matthew chapter 2, where it talks about Herod, and if I'll read it for you a little bit more from this Unger's Bible Dictionary. It says that after the fall of Jerusalem in 587 BC, the Edomites began to advance northwards, and by 312 BC, the Nabateans, who established themselves in Edom, drove them from Petra. The Edomites were gradually pushed into the southern half of Judea, including the region around Hebron, an area that the Greeks later called Idumea. Judas Maccabeus warred against them for half a century, and then half a century later, Hyrcanus, I think it is, completely subdued them and imposed the rite of circumcision and invoked the old Jewish law of assembly. Julius Caesar in 47 BC appointed an Idumean, which is Antipater, procurator of Judea, Samaria, and Galilee, and then Herod, who was the son of Antipater, was crowned king of the Jews in 37 BC. So Herod was an Idumean. He was an Edomite. And when Titus besieged Jerusalem, the Idumeans joined the Jews. This is in AD 70. The Idumeans joined the Jews in rebellion against Rome, and Josephus says that 20,000 Idumeans were admitted as defenders of the holy city, but once were in, proceeded to rob and kill. But the traitors received the exact same fate as the few surviving Jews when Rome then took over Jerusalem, Idumea and Edom. And it says Idumea and Edom ceased to be from that point. So as far as the Edomites that were known in that area, in the area of Mount Seir, they were wiped out completely. So that's as far as the Bible dictionaries are concerned. That's what they look at. They see the prophecies regarding Edom. They see how it's going to be wiped out. They see how this particular area about Mount Seir, about Petra, how they had succeeding invasions, and they in fact put two and two together, and they come up with what they think is four. But there's a little bit more to it than that. If we turn back to Genesis 27, Genesis 27. I want you to notice in Genesis 27, in verse 28, it says, therefore God give you, now this is to Jacob. He says, therefore God give you the dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth, plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be lord over your brethren. Let your mother's son bow down to you. Cursed is everyone that curses you, and blessed is he that blesses you. Now that's of Jacob, And in chapter 27, verse 39, and Isaac his father answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling shall be away from, as it says in Moffat, the fatness of the earth, and away from the dew of heaven from above, and by your sword shall you live, and shall serve your brother, and it will come to pass that when you have the dominion, that you will break his yoke from off your neck. Now, when we see this passage here regarding Jacob, we know that that was passed down to Ephraim and Manasseh. And it's not just a single nation. It's Ephraim and Manasseh, but it also goes to, as far as Ephraim is concerned, you're looking at other areas such as Australia, and you're looking at New Zealand, you're looking at Canada, you're looking at South Africa, Rhodesia, various other areas around the earth. And in addition to that, you're looking at other areas. You're looking at Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, the various Brussels, Belgium, Holland, these other areas as well, and also northern France. Now, notice how I say northern France, because when you go to southern France, you're looking at a different genetic makeup, and you're looking at not Israelitish, they're not Reubenites, in the southern parts of France, there are Gentile influence in there, and it tends to be the northern French that tends to be the Reubenites. This is the way we've always understood it to be. So what I'm saying to you is that you see here how within Israel, there are several different nations involved, it's not just one. It is the same as far as Edom as well, because when you're looking at Edom, they pushed eastward out of the area that was known as Edom as far as Israel was concerned, as far as Judah and Jerusalem were concerned. They pushed out into these other areas, into the area about Iran, Iraq, Jordan, further north into Azerbaijan and all the other areas as well, Kazakhstan, Turkestan, and various other places such as this. Now, that's not where they primarily are. The primary area is Turkey. That's the area that is the primary area. But there are pockets of Turks, or Turkish ethnically Turks, in these other areas as well. So, how did the area of Edom, come back from the dead? It's presumably from these other areas. The other areas, they were not completely destroyed. Now, if we notice, I'd just like to read you an article that talks about the descendants of Teman. Now, this is from the British Israel Society, who have done more research than I certainly have on the actual races themselves. It says, each specific son of Edom is virtually impossible to trace, but Teman, a grandson via Eliphaz, whose mother was Adar the Hittite, became preeminent among his brethren, the leading tribe. So Teman was the leading tribe. The region of Persia and Turkestan became known as the land of Timani, after him. So these people had gone across into this area. They came known as the land of Timani after Teman. And it says, one of the kings of Timani was Husham, and he's the king Hushan of ancient history. His native land was Persia, indicating that even at such an early date, the Edomites were migrating out of Palestine and the surrounding districts. It says many of the Edomites dwelt in northern Persia at this time. Now, they're not the Persians today, but nevertheless, they were dwelling at that particular time. It says a descendant of Husham was Aliphdun, who had two sons, firstly called Tur, who ruled over the Edomites in Central Asia. This may be the origin of the name Turkestan. Turk, or Turanian, so both Turkestan, Turk or Turanian, probably came from this particular individual called Tur. And he was in this area around Persia at that particular time. That's where it started. But as I say, the ethnic tribe of Edom goes beyond. There's other tribes all involved at that time. It says the second son was Irige, I think it is pronounced. It says he was surnamed Pheros, or Perses of Greek legend. Persia may even be named after him. It's interesting that some of the Turks claim descendants from an individual named Turk, but some 19th century historians supposed him to be a grandson of Japheth. Another clue may be that the Hor Turks, which reveals the name of the Horites, who were associated with the Edomites in Genesis 36. But that gives an idea as to where the name Turkey actually came from. And it mentions here, it talks about the Ottoman Turks, and again, Otiman, Ottoman Turks, came over to Islam in the 10th century. This religion was very attractive for a number of reasons. Now we're looking at 10th century, that's 1000 AD. Okay? It was intrinsically suitable to a warrior people. Now again, as I've mentioned before, when we're looking at Islam, we're looking at a religion that started around about 500 AD, and it was designed for the end time. We're looking at something that's been designed for our time today. And certainly, one of the peoples that embraced this religion and spread it far and wide were the Ottoman Turks. It was the Ottoman Empire, which lasted right through until the First World War. It was intrinsically suitable to a warrior people. It had wonderful rewards, particularly for fighting men who die in war, and in the path of Allah, The Turks have remained overwhelmingly Islamic ever since. Also in the Central Asian republics, they're also Islamic. Now, in Kazakhstan, which has a 17 million population, 42% are Kazakhs, 38% are Russian, and 4.5% are Ukrainian. In Kyrgyzstan, you've got 4.5 million population, 52% are Kyrgyz, 21% are Russian, and 13 are Uzbeks. And it goes down, it starts listing these various Istans that you find out in this area, and you find that they're not one ethnic tribe. There's a whole series of tribes amongst them, and they tend to fight amongst themselves, as we've just been witnessing in Beslan. Beslan is a result. This is not just something that happened and flew out of the blue, a clear blue sky. This feud had been going on for centuries, perhaps millennia, and it was just a part of a progressive feud that occurred. And it was when you're looking at that particular area of the world, you're looking at this this constant feudism. One thing I was meant to bring was Winston Churchill's early life, and in there he talks about Afghanistan and the warring tribes in amongst Afghanistan. That they were fighting each other all the time until the British came in, then got somebody else to get band together and fight against. So they then fought against the British, and they fought against the Russians when they came in, they fought against the Americans when they've been in, and they'll be fighting. And if they manage to have the Americans pull out of Afghanistan, they'll start fighting amongst themselves again, because they're not one ethnic tribe. There's a whole the Pashtuns and all the various other ones within that area. But it says, thus the vast majority of the tribes of Central Asia, it says, are Turkic by language and Islamic by religion. Still many others, though in the minority, dwell within the Xinjiang province in China. Northern Afghanistan, parts of southwestern Iran are basically pastoralists. The article goes on a great deal, but I'm not going to read it all. So when we're looking at Edom today, we're looking certainly at Turkey. Turkey is the predominant one. We're looking at Teman as being the firstborn. He was the dominant. He presumably came across from the eastern side and came and settled in the area of Turkey. But there are also splinters as well of Edom going throughout this region. Uzbekistan, I can't even pronounce some of these particular ones, but Tajikistan, Afghanistan, certain areas of Afghanistan, Armenia, I'm not sure about Armenia, but certainly Armenia is in that area, Georgia also, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, and so on, all these kind of ands that are in that particular area. Now, if we go on to the end time prophecies, and that's really what we're looking at. We're not looking so much at the history. We're looking more at the end time, what happens regarding the end time. There is a specific book, one book in the Bible, and that is the book of Obadiah. And if you go to Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, it's just one chapter long. It's a very short book, one of the shortest books in the Bible. But it is all about Edom. And it is dual in its prophetic nature. There is a type at the axial period of Jeremiah being mentioned here, but as so often happens, the prophet is looking at what is about to happen, and he sees, it's like looking at two or three hills. He looks at a hill and he doesn't realize that the hill behind it is not part of that mountain range, but another one way, way down the future. And he therefore can see both of them, and he foresees both occurrences, both the type and also the primary fulfillment. And here in Obadiah, we find, I'm not going to read all of Obadiah, but in verse 15, it says, "For the day of the Eternal is near upon all the nations, and as you have done, it will be done to you. Your reward shall return upon your own head." But this is the day of the Eternal that is being mentioned here. And it talks at the very end, right at the end of Obadiah, how the kingdom is going to be the Eternal's. Now, we haven't got, this isn't the kingdom of God. We've never had the kingdom of God, but it's looking down into the future. And it looks down into that time when the kingdom of God will indeed be there. Now, if you want to put a marker in Obadiah, because we'll be coming back to it, I want you to point something out to you in Genesis chapter 27. Genesis 27, I referred to it earlier on, but I think it's worth going back and actually reading here in Genesis 27. Because it says here in verse 39, it says, "And Isaac his father answered and said to him, Behold, your dwelling shall be away from the fatness of the earth, and away from the dew of heaven from above. And by your sword shall you live, and you shall serve your brother." Now that's the prophecy. Edom was called to serve his brother Jacob. That was his purpose in life, as far as God is concerned. It says that the older will serve the younger. And that is the prophecy that was given to Rebekah, and it's also the prophecy that's given here. And it will come to pass that when you have the dominion, that you'll break his yoke from off your neck. But breaking that yoke off the neck is not the purpose as far as God is concerned. Now, we see partially the breaking of the yoke off the neck, even in recent times. We can see how, the pressure is starting to be placed on the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War. You know, pre-World War I, the Ottoman Empire was actually in control of Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, Palestine, Arabia, Yemen, and the islands of the Aegean. That was the Ottoman Empire. That was just before World War I. So that's within the last century. And at that time, because it joined Germany in World War I, and when Britain got in there, it broke up the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire no longer exists. It ceased to be an empire. Now, this is quite important in some ways, because when we look into the future, let's first of all turn over to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. Remember how you're looking at the certain attitude of mind of a certain type of person. You know, nations are made up of peoples, and God could see certain characteristics within even the young children, within the womb of Rebekah. But Hebrews chapter 12, and we're looking in verse 14, it says, "Follow peace with all, and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled." Now notice, as far as any root of bitterness, I mean, this is what, you know, if you look to notice, go back to Genesis 27, you don't have to turn there, but if you want to put it in your notes, I think it's verse 41, that from that point Esau hated Jacob, absolutely hated, he had a root of bitterness against him. Instead of serving him, which is what God had foretold, and what will happen in the future, he hated him. And here it says, "Looking diligently, lest any man fall from the grace and root of bitterness spring up trouble you, many of you defile, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. So his attitude of mind that Paul brings out here in Hebrews, which was towards his birthright, and it was to do with the generations that would then issue from him, his attitude of mind was to go ahead and sell it for the mean, for a bowl of soup. And this is the kind of attitude of mind of a fornicator, of somebody who goes out and spreads his seed wherever he wants to, just for the spur of the moment, just to get the pleasures of the moment, and without any kind of regard to the children that are being begotten by this individual. And this is the attitude of mind. I mean, we see it all the time today, but it's interesting how that is then tied up with Esau and this frame of mind, live for the moment and, you know, never mind the future, kind of attitude towards a birthright. You can see how this nation as such is going to be scattered across the entire area of the Caspian Sea and all of these areas because of this fornicating like attitude of mind. If you go back to Obadiah again, which I hope you have a marker in, and you look in chapter, well, there's only one chapter, chapter 1, if you look in verse 11, it says, well, let's go back a little. Let's go back a little bit. Well, let's read Obadiah. Why not? It says, "The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord Eternal concerning Edom. We've heard a rumor from the Eternal. An ambassador is sent among the nations. Arise and let us go. We'll rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. And the pride of your heart has deceived you, that you that dwell in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that says it in heart, who will bring me down to the ground?" So, you know, historically they lived in these caves. They lived in the caves on either side of their homeland, round Mount Seir. But it also was an attitude of mind. It says, "Though you exalt yourself as the eagles, though you nest among the stars, there I will bring you down, says the Eternal. If the thieves came to you, if robbers by night, how are you cut off? Wouldn't they have stolen till they'd had enough? If the great gatherers came to you, wouldn't they just leave some grapes? How are the things of Esau searched out? How are the hidden things sought up? All the men of your confederacy have brought you, even to the border." Notice there is a confederacy that is being mentioned of here, and we'll go and read about that confederacy. And this again is going flowing down into the end time prophecy. "The men that were at peace with you have deceived you and prevailed against you." So they're talking about peace, but they're deceiving them. They're prevailing against you. "They that eat your bread have laid a wound under you. There's no understanding in him." And it talks, remember, it talks about the, you go back into Jeremiah, it talks about how the wisdom of these people, they reckon they're wise. "Shall I not in that day, says the Eternal, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of the mount of Esau? And your mighty, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter." It's going to wipe out this particular area of the world. And this area, the mount of Esau, this mount, this nation of Esau, which is presumably Turkey, because the other ones, there'll be Esau, you know, there'll be Turkish people there, but they're not a nation. But here it's talking about the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. "For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you will be cut off forever." Now, where is the name of Jacob mentioned? Where is the name of Jacob placed? It's placed on Ephraim and Manasseh. It wasn't placed on the Jews. It was placed on Ephraim and Manasseh. And it's because of the violence against your brother Jacob in the area of this confederacy. You should be cut off forever. "In the day that you stood on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces and foreigners entered into the gates and cast lost upon Jerusalem, even you were as one of them." So the indication is that the northern beast power will go down into the area, and he will be one of them. He will be one of this confederacy. "But you should not have looked on that day on your brother, in the day that he became a stranger. Neither should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Neither should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress." You should not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. You should not have looked upon their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor have laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. Neither should you have stood in the crossway or the Dardanelles. And, you know, stopped, and it says, to cut off those that escaped. Neither should you have delivered up those that his that remained in the day of distress. Now, if the beast power comes down, it'll come down through Lebanon, it'll come down through Syria. And presumably these nations will be defeated. One of the areas that the British, the Americans, the Israelis will be able to flee from up would actually be able to flee up into that area through Syria, through Lebanon, into the area of Turkey. But the indication is here that at the Dardanelles they will stop them and they will hand them over to the beast power. For the day of the Eternal is near upon all the nations, all the heathen, and as you have done, it'll be done to you. So they dealt treacherously, and it'll be done to you, and your reward will return upon your own head. For if you have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the nations drink continually. Yeah, they'll drink, they'll swallow down, it'll be as though they have not been, as though Edom has not been. This mount of Edom, this nation that is identified as Edom, which is Turkey, will be as if they haven't been. But upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there will be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they'll kindle in them and devour them, and there will be not any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Eternal has spoken. So they will be destroyed. They will be wiped out. And they will be of the south, will possess the mount of Esau, and they of the plain, the Philistines, and they will possess the fields of Ephraim, and the fields of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead. And the captivity of this host of the children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even to Zarephath, and the captivity of Jerusalem, which is Sephard, and so on. And it says, and saviors shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Eternal. So this area in the north, which is the area of Turkey, will in fact be part of the very kingdom of God. But the Edomites that were in there, the Mount of Edom, is going to be wiped out. Now, as it says, it talks about you were one of them. I just want to read something which was in the paper the other day. I think it was 2 days ago. A little tiny article. You almost miss it. Under World Bulletin, it's about, 3 inches long, one column. It says, EU offers Iran nuclear expertise. And it says, Iran is considering a proposal by the European Union to abandon its uranium enrichment program in exchange for nuclear technology, a Tehran official said yesterday. Now, as I mentioned to you before, Germany, in the last war, leapfrogged over the armaments of Britain and America because it had the modern weaponry. And it was able, therefore, and Britain and America had to catch up desperately to try and catch up. If there's an area that Germany is predominant in, it is in superpowered lasers. And the area of superpowered lasers is an area which, put that together with nuclear technology, and you have something which is absolutely lethal. You're not looking, I mean, you look at a light bulb, it's 60 watts. You look at a bar of a fire, that's a kilowatt, 1 kilowatt. You look at a power station, it's measured in megawatts. You then get gigawatts, you then get terawatts, and each one is 1,000 times what the one before. You can get gigawatts, you can get terawatts, and then you get petawatts. And these lasers are actually measured in petawatt. They are phenomenally powerful. But what they can do is that instead of having a nuclear explosion to generate a hydrogen-based fusion explosion, by irradiating the heavy water, the deuterium, with super lasers, you can do exactly the same thing, and you can also scale the hydrogen explosion, the actual fusion explosion, down into something even the size of the bullet, if you had something, you know, a sufficiently powerful laser that you could pack into a bullet. So you could fire a bullet at a tank and not only just blow the tank up, but everything, all surrounding armies could disappear and be killed by the radiation that would be there. And because there's no uranium or fission material, you're then also looking at the fact that the troops can then march in after in a few hours and without any side effects. And it says here that the European Union, Iran is considering a proposal by the European Union to abandon its uranium enrichment program in exchange for nuclear technology, a Tehran official said yesterday. It's just at the initial stage. The matter has to be considered by both sides, added Sirius Nazeri. If Iran rejects the EU offer outright, diplomats say most European nations will back the US demands to report it to the United Nations Security Council for economic sanctions. Now, if we turn over to again, turn over to Psalm. Well, put a marker in Obadiah, but turn over to Psalm 83, Psalm which I've read many times. Here it talks about the Confederacy. It says, verse 1, "Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still, O God. For lo, your enemies make a tumult, and those that hate you have lifted up the head. They've taken crafty counsel against your people, consulted against your hidden ones. They've said, 'Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance.' For they have consulted together." They have a confederacy. They've consulted together. With one consent, they are confederate against you. The tabernacles of Edom. So here we have the Edomites as part of this confederacy. And the Ishmaelites of Moab and the Hagarenes, and it gives the list of the Arabic and those nations. And it says in verse 8, it says, Asher, now this Asher is Assyria, also is joined with them. They, that's the Assyrians, have helped the children of Lot. That's Moab and Ammon. Now, where Moab and Ammon come into this and how Moab and Ammon actually deal with it, I don't know. But when we look at this, this World Bulletin, and we're looking at the EU offering Iran nuclear expertise in exchange for getting rid of their old programs, and what exactly that expertise is, knowing that Germany does in fact have this expertise in superpowered lasers, and it is the next generation of atomic weapons. It is the one which will bypass and skip over the top of the present generations of atomic weapons. They're atomic weapons that you can use. Now, anybody that actually has one go off, you will see radiation burns. You'll see enormous damage if the thing is big enough. Just as an atomic weapon, they're undetectable by satellite. Because there's nothing. What are they? They're just electronics in the actual laser, and in addition to that, you've got deuterium, which is heavy water, which is a form of water. It's all around the Earth. There's nothing radioactive there that you can see until the laser irradiates the deuterium, and that produces the fusion. And so you've got a weapon which is very much different, and it means therefore that somebody who witnesses the explosion like that, they will not know whether there's radiation in. I mean, how many of us have got Geiger counters? We have no idea whether there's radiation in the atmosphere or not. And if we're told you've got to leave this area, you can be herded out of an area. Your cities can be laid waste. You can be herded out of the area, and the beast power can take over that area that's left. And they can march in, they can do whatever they wish. So the indication is that something along those lines will happen. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah 11 obviously is looking into the future, into the millennium. In Isaiah 11, it talks about the wolf dwelling with the lamb, and verse 6, and it says, "Won't hurt or destroy." And it says in verse 10, "And in that day there will be a root of Jesse, which will stand for an ensign of the people, and to it the Gentiles, the nations, will seek, and his rest will be glorious. And it will come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, Cush, and Elam, Shinar, and Hamath, and the islands of the sea. And he will set up an ensign for the nations, and will assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, Judah shall not vex Ephraim, but they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines towards the west. They will spoil them of the east together. They will lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. So Edom is going to be there, and the Eternal shall utterly destroy the Egyptian sea. The indication is that Edom itself is going to be destroyed, but the land seems to be saved to some degree. It's interesting in this light as to what in fact is happening in this confederacy and in this area around Jerusalem. The Catholics, apparently, I couldn't print it out because I haven't got a printer connected up to the computer here, but the Catholics have rediscovered their Jewish roots, that they don't look upon the Jews as enemies anymore, but partners, and they've got this idea that Jerusalem has a sacred character for all the children of Abraham. This is a statement the Catholics are now making. And our job, the inference is that our job is to preserve it for all. Now, if that doesn't sound like making Jerusalem an international city, I don't know quite what is. But these things, this is literally in the last day this statement has been made, in the context also about this consultant to the Vatican that came out and said John Kerry, who apparently is Catholic, risks excommunication for his attitude on abortion. And they're recommending the 20% of the USA, which are Catholics, and there's 20% of the USA are Catholics, that they should go ahead and vote for Bush, for President Bush. So apparently there's over 1 million abortions in the USA last year alone. And so things are happening, things are going on in that area. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 6. You see what in fact will cause this utter destruction in the area around that area of Turkey. Isaiah chapter, sorry, not 6, beg your pardon, Isaiah 63. Isaiah chapter 63. It says, "Who is this that comes from Edom, with dyed garments from Bozrah, that is glorious in his apparel, travelling in the greatness of his strength? I that speak righteousness, mighty to save. Why are you red with your apparel, and your garments like him that treads the wine fat? I've trodden the winepress alone with the people who has none with me, for I'll tread them in my anger and trample them in my fury, and my blood will be splattered upon the garments, and I'll stain my raiment. For the day of vengeance is in my heart. The year of my redeemed is come. And I looked, and there was none to help, and I wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore my own arm brought salvation to me. My fury it upheld me, and I will tread down the people in my anger, make them drink in my fury, and I'll bring down the strength, their strength to the earth." Now this, you know, poetic way of putting it is that Edom is red, and it is this area of Edom, in Bozrah, this capital of Edom, and it's glorious in his apparel, so it's from the area of Edom. And it's interesting, if you turn over to Revelation 14, just a few scriptures just now in closing, Revelation chapter 14, we find something mentioned about the beast power in Revelation 14. And it's only when you realize where it's coming from, where this quotation is coming from, that it starts to make a bit more sense. Revelation chapter 14, verse 9, it says, "The third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive a mark on his forehead or his hand, to the same shall drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture, in the cup of indignation. He'll be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends up forever, and they have no rest day or night that worship, or no respite day or night that worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints." Now, we're looking at that really as part of the patience of the saints, because they realize what actually was going to happen. And because when you look at where that is quoted from, you turn back to Isaiah 34, you find a scripture here, Isaiah 34, It says, "Come, you nations," verse 1, "to hear and listen, you people. Let the earth hear and all that's in them, the world and the things that come forth of it. For the indignation of the Eternal is upon all nations, his fury upon all their armies. He's utterly destroyed them, he's delivered them to the slaughter." Remember, it is from this area, through Turkey, through Azerbaijan, through Uzbekistan, all this area, the eastern hordes will come. And they will come through, and it says the land is like Eden behind, in front of them, and a burning desolate wilderness behind. So you're looking at this army coming through, destroying everything in its path. And then the Eternal comes and has Armageddon, which is slightly, you know, a good deal further south. But the armies are still up in the north. They're still up in the Turkish area. And here we're looking, it says, "The slain also shall be cast out," verse 3, "and their stink shall come up in the carcass, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. And all the hosts of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll." Now you know full well what this is talking about. It is the end time. "And all their hosts shall fall down as a leaf falls from the vine, as a falling of a fig tree. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Edomir." Here is the land of Edom. "And upon the people of the curse of the, my curse to judgment. The sword of the Eternal is filled with blood. It is fat with the fatness, and with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. And the Eternal has a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edomir." Now we look at Beslan, and you look at the horrendous thing that the Chechens did there. Their time is coming. You know, this is the patience of the saints. We watch this and we see that area where we're going to see far worse than that, because you're going to notice the time once the Azerbaijan, once it finally gets the oil coming through, it'll use it to build up armaments. And he says, "And the unicorn shall come down with them, and the bullocks and the bulls, and their land will be soaked with blood, and their dust made fat with the fatness. For it's the day of the Eternal's vengeance, the year of recompense for the controversy of Zion. And the streams thereof shall be turned to pitch, the dust to brimstone, the land will become burning pitch, and it will not be quenched day or night. The smoke thereof will go up forever, from generation to generation it will lie waste. None will pass through it forever and ever." This area where God actually does intervene is going to be a wilderness, an absolute desolate wilderness, and presumably perhaps a certain area left, and it goes on and describes what in fact will be there. Couple of scriptures in closing. Habakkuk 3. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk. This is the blues. This is the sad song upon Shigaloth in verse 1 of chapter 3. "O Eternal, I have heard your speech, I was afraid. Eternal, revive your work in the midst of years. In the midst of years, make known the wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran." So here he is from Teman, from Turkey. "Selah," think of it. Just think and meditate about it. Why is he going to come from this area? Because there is real problems. And when we see what's happening in the news, when we see what is about to happen, we can understand the problems that will be there. "His glory covers the heavens, the earth is full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light. He had horns," or he had bright beams that came out of his sides. And it says, "there were hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood, he measured the earth. He beheld and he drove asunder the nations. The everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills bowed. His ways were everlasting." The Azerbaijans, all of the other nations are going to be scattered. "I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. Midian was trembling. The Eternal displeased against the river. Was your anger against rivers? Was your wrath against the sea? You rode your chariots and the horses of salvation. Your bow was made quite naked according to the oaths of the tribe. You split the mountains with the rivers. The mountains saw you, they trembled, they overflowed with water past the deep utterance of his voice, and the sun and moon stood still in their habitation." This is God intervening in the world at that time. And the intervention seems to be the area that we know today as Turkey. It'll already have had the northern tribes come through, be turned into a wilderness. And yet when God intervenes, he'll fight against these nations, the beast power itself, and the nations as well coming in from the east, and he'll destroy the lot of them. And so we're looking at something which is described there. Final scriptures, go back into Obadiah again, and just realize what it talks about. Where it says here in verse 21, it says, "And saviors shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdoms shall be the Eternal's." That's our job. It is the rescuers, the saviors, the ones who come from Mount Zion, which is the church, and they will take over a portion of this land. Some of it will be perpetually waste, will be left perpetually in desolation. But the actual nation of Edom will be no more. There'll be no mountain of Edom whatsoever. They'll be wiped out off the face of the earth. And so as we see the things that are happening currently in this area, Turkey is the mountain of Edom, yes, but we're looking at other areas of Edom in the Azerbaijans and the wickedness and the brutality that will be there. Again, the patience of the saints is to understand what actually will take place on this nation, on these peoples. And we do need to make sure we understand that, because the times ahead do not look very bright at all, particularly for that area of the world.